This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, March 26th, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas sits down with House Speaker-designate Jeremy Gillum and old elected Senate President-designate Jonathan Dismang. Plus, we get a tour of Collier Drug's compounding pharmacy.
And in honor of National Poetry Month being celebrated in April, we talk to three local poets about their art form. Those stories and more. But first, one of Clinton's fiercer media opponents from the 1990s, David Brock, spoke at the Clinton School of Public Service yesterday as the repentant founder of the nonprofit media watchdog Media Matters. Brock described his previous role in writing for the conservative American Spectator magazine.
I was part of what Hillary Clinton would later call the vast right-wing conspiracy. Now, when Mrs. Clinton made that remark about the political opposition back in the late 1990s, insiders scoffed, but she was right.
Brock's current organization critiques right-wing media sources such as Fox News. Speaking at the Clinton School of Public Service, Brock explained the manipulation of media as he understands it.
Successor websites to Drudge, Breitbart.com, The Daily Caller, and The Washington Free Beacon have as their sole goal slandering their political opponents. Their function in the media ecosystem is to launder dirt fed to them by Republican operatives and dress it up as real journalism, all in the expectation that the mainstream will be goaded into following along.
Brock said a turning point in his career came when he was informed stories being fed to him, including Troopergate, were full of misinformation and outright fabrication from sources being paid by wealthy conservatives. Brock says he sees the same problems today from sources like the Koch brothers and already sees old attacks being revived by Senator Rand Paul against Hillary Clinton.
Former Arkansas Treasurer Martha Shoffner yesterday asked for a court-appointed attorney. Earlier this month, a jury found her guilty of 6 counts of extortion, a count of attempted extortion, and 7 counts of receipt of bribery. But she still faces 10 federal charges of mail fraud in a separate trial. According to Talk Business Arkansas, Shoffner asked U.S. District Judge Leon Holmes to appoint attorney Grant Ballard, one of 2 attorneys representing her, to continue representing her, but at the government's expense. She claimed that legal fees and costs to date have exhausted her financial resources and that she has been unsuccessful in borrowing money for her legal defense from family, friends, or other credit sources, leaving her unable to pay defense costs through the rest of the upcoming trial. Shoffner's other attorney, Charles Banks, said in yesterday's filing that he would continue to represent his client without seeking compensation from the government.
Plans for the Ben Guerin Aquatic Center in Fort Smith are moving along as both city and Sebastian County officials have agreed on final design plans for the park. David Hudson, Sebastian County judge, says the final design retains many of the amenities originally envisioned for the facility.
So we have a wave pool. We have a child's area with a zero entry layout. We have 4 slides and a lazy river, and that's the overall concept that is being put out to bid. Those bids are due back April the 10th, and at that time we'll get a clear understanding of where we are in regard to being able to build what we've planned for the budget of $10,900,000.
Hudson says the roughly 30 separate bid packages will open for bids April 10th. Once both the city and county governments approve the final bid contracts, Hudson says the next step will be to update the facility's operating plan.
And that would include the current layout with the wave pool and all of the other amenities. And based on their expertise and background, they'll know how to staff appropriately the facility. And then they also know how to calculate the various expense line items so we can get a bottom line on an operating budget. And then they'll be looking at regional pricing, and we'll be looking at pricing options to determine revenue stream and make a comparison of the projected operating cost to the projected revenue stream for the facility.
If everything goes as planned, the facility should open as scheduled on Memorial Day of 2015.
In a 5-2 vote last night, Rogers Alderman asked to close the majority of the road around Lake at Atlanta as part of the broader redevelopment of the lake. The vote gives the city administration the means to close the road from Timber Trails on the east side, northward around the lake end over to the Edwards property on the lake's western side.
Students at the University of Arkansas Fort Smith will soon be paying more in fees to fund construction of a new fitness area for the campus. According to the City Wire, students will pay a new fee of $5 per each credit hour they take. In return, students will get a facility that will include a 5,800-square-foot fitness area, a 2,600-square-foot individual and small group fitness area, three studio rooms, and potentially a two-story rock wall in addition to basketball courts and a three-lane running track. The Recreation Center is one of two buildings to receive approval as part of the college's latest master plan that was revealed last year.
The Razorback baseball team yesterday won 2 of 2 in a doubleheader at Baum Stadium against Mississippi Valley State. Arkansas won the first game 6-0, and the Razorbacks won the second game with a final score of 12-1. The two wins put Arkansas at 15-8 on the season, and the Razorbacks will attempt to make a clean sweep of the midweek series when the two teams finish the three-game set this evening at Dickey Stevens Park in North Little Rock.
Meanwhile, the Razorback softball team split its doubleheader last night at Jackson State, winning Game 1 with a final score of 7-4 and dropping the second decision 3-1. The doubleheader puts Arkansas at 23-11 on the season. The softball team returns home for a four-game homestand beginning Friday with a weekend series against Texas A&M.
Cloudy tonight with a 30% chance of showers and lows in the mid-40s, rising to the lower 50s by morning. Mostly cloudy tomorrow with a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms and highs from 70 in northwest Arkansas to 74 in the Arkansas River Valley. Partly cloudy tomorrow night with a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms and lows from 39 to 48. This is Ozarks at Large. Last week, the Arkansas legislature overturned a governor's veto, officially closed its fiscal session business, and the House of Representatives elected a new designated speaker. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas recently sat down with Janelle Lilly, lead Capitol reporter for KATV. Newly elected House Speaker-designate Jeremy Gillum, and old elected Senate President-designate Jonathan Dismang for a conversation.
With the private option battle ending for this year, it looks all roads point to next year the same thing happening again. How is it going to be any different? Is getting through it this year going to change the way that you guys approach it next year?
I mean, I think the biggest thing is we're going to have real data and we'll have some experience that we'll be able to look at and make sure that it's moving in the direction that we intended it to, you know, kind of first and foremost. You know, as ASA has said in some recent announcements, you know, right now it is law of the land. And if he's elected, he would take a look at it and establish some reforms based on the direction that he would like to provide. And so, you know, the private option was never meant to be stagnant. It was always supposed to be something that, you know, was changed and moved, and I think we'll see that within the next session. But again, it will be contentious as it has been last session, and that will be, I think that's just part of the reality in regards to the private option.
Well, you had an easier time of it in the Senate than the House did. What about the House?
Well, I think that, and I think Senator Desmond keyed on something very important there, is the fluidity of the situation. I mean, the data coming in as it's being implemented is going to tell us all a lot of things. And I think as long as the members are getting communicated to and they're in the meetings and we're studying it as we move forward, I think there's a chance of having consensus moving into the session. And that's what we're going to be really trying to strive for, is to make sure that the members are on the same page, and hopefully we'll be able to avoid some of the same circumstances we found ourselves in the fiscal session.
Absent the data that you're going to be working, absent the data that you're going to be looking at, are there some specific things that you want to see changed or that you already have an idea need to be changed or moved in a different direction.
I think the health savings account program, which was part of the original law, but also here more recently we mandated that actually take place for the program to continue. I think, you know, the development of that program will be critical as things move forward. And also think in regards to emergency transportation and that waiver request that's been put out, or we haven't put it out yet, but development of that at this point will be very important as we move forward. And I think those two things, you know, is what's identified right now as priority. But again, I think it will evolve as it's meant to evolve, and there'll be other input and other discussions. And I think, I mean, I am certain there will be change in direction and change of priorities before we get into the next session.
Either one of you willing to be the person that helps wind it down, if that's what the data suggests that you should do?
Well, I think if we get to that point where we begin next session and the membership, you know, looks at it and says, look, this is not working like we need it to, and we can't see a viable option of changing it and still moving it forward, then we'll go that direction. I mean, we're going to be responsible in how we do it and make sure that it's done in the proper way. But if that's the will of our body, then we'll take that direction.
And I understand there's already a committee formed for that purpose that John Burris is leading at this point, right?
Yes.
Let's talk about the veto override this week. The governor vetoed this tax break bill for the natural gas industry, and some splitting hairs as to how to define if it was a tax break or not a tax break. I don't want to debate that, but the governor's basically said that COLAs for state employees are now threatened. Do you guys feel that the COLAs for state employees should be threatened? It's a pretty small percentage of the budget.
Right. I think it's 0.1% of the overall forecast. And, you know, I guess, you know, the governor is very conservative in his budgeting and especially in his forecast. You know, we've talked to BLR legislative research quite a bit in the last few days and even prior to when we were, you know, working through the forecast. And they feel like it is conservative and will come in above, which means that AB and even B1, which is where the COLAs are, and possibly C could even be funded. And so I'm fairly confident that we'll get to that point. But of course, if the governor does change the forecast and revises it down, it would require him or the next governor to revise it back up as the revenues actually come in and we get to, or the, you know, the reality versus the forecast.
Can we talk about the campaign season that's coming up and what your plans are for that? I mean, you were elected by Republicans and Democrats, and so I'm curious what that means as far as, are you going to go stump for people in contested districts? Do you have any standards as that goes?
Well, my philosophy basically has been the same since I got in the House, and that's to show the utmost respect to my colleagues that I serve with, and so I'm not going to be out campaigning against my colleagues. We've got several open seats and some primaries that are just Republican primaries, and so I think there's plenty of things to keep me busy in planning the House and getting ready and moving forward in the next session that I won't have to be out campaigning against my fellow colleagues.
I got a question for you on the Senate side of things. The House has done an admirable job of live streaming all of their business. Senate seems to be a little slower to the take on this. You're going to be in leadership position now to force that. Do you see opening up the Senate proceedings, the Senate committee meetings, to live streaming to open it up to more people around the state?
I mean, I think it's something that we'll discuss, but it's something we'll discuss as a whole. You know, it would not be my decision solely to move forward either way.
What will you push for?
I mean, in some ways, it's something that I'm supportive of. I would like to be able to, you know, to have that broadcast and have that representation out there. But again, the Senate's a little bit different body. For instance, we don't use microphones on the Senate floor. That would have to change if we're going to be recording or, you know, videoing what we do for, you know, to be able to hear what we're saying. And so I'm just not sure at this point, number one, what the costs are going to be, number two, how it changes the climate of the Senate or the atmosphere of the Senate. And I think all those things have to be looked at before we make a firm decision in how we move forward.
We have committee assignments to talk about, because I think this is something, after what happened last year with Speaker Carter, the Republicans taking control of the House and all of that drama that came along with it, committee assignments became an issue that was talked about throughout the whole rest of the regular session and the fiscal session. So tell me what your plans are with that.
Well, right now, I think that given the nature of the dynamics in the House, and I'm a firm believer in proportionate representation. And so I don't look like, at this point, it doesn't look like we're going to be reinventing the wheel on that. I think Speaker Carter laid out a really good platform and a design on how to do the committee assignments as far as Democrats and Republicans. And so I look probably to follow along those lines. And of course, the elections in November will make some difference in that as far as who's elected and things So we'll go from there. So it's not necessarily set in stone at this point, but that looks to be the direction we're going to go.
Have you given anyone a committee chairmanship yet?
Nope, not a one. I've had several that have asked me to make sure that they do not get one. And so I've had more of that than I have the other. So.
Does anything change down in the Senate in terms of how you guys do your committee assignments?
You know, of course, the pro tem does not have as much influence on assignments as, mm-hmm. for instance, the Speaker does. One of the biggest issues there would be a budget chair. Senator Teague has done a great job for Senator Lamro this current session. And, you know, we haven't visited yet about what he would like to do moving forward, but that would probably be one of the more prominent positions that we'd have some influence on.
You think you might keep him in that role?
You know, that's what I'd like to do. But again, I haven't had that conversation with him to make sure that's, you know, he would like to continue to serve in that capacity.
That was Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business Arkansas, speaking with Janelle Lilly, lead Capitol reporter for KATV, newly elected House Speaker-designate Jeremy Gillum, and old elected Senate President-designate Jonathan Dismaying. That interview originally aired on Talk Business and Politics with Roby Brock, which can be seen Sunday mornings at 9 on KATV in the Central Arkansas market. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com.
And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. And the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. More information at ArkansasStateChamber.com.
Thank you so much, Stephen Cefalo, for being on the Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South.
That week, I received a letter from Harold. Actually, it was not so much a letter as it was a disturbing sort of poem or magical spell. "You will belong to me," it read. "I am a tower that rises up all around you, and the only way you can see out is through my eyes." I was horrified.
Listen to Tales from the South Saturdays at 3:30 on KUAF3.
There are several events scheduled in Fayetteville throughout April as part of National Poetry Month. Some say poetry is dead, but what do local poets think?
I think poets just are going to keep doing what they're doing. I mean, we all have our cadres and our groups of friends, and we all just kind of thrive off of that smaller energy, and people keep coming to it. And once somebody comes in, and if somebody's looking for what poetry has to offer and they step into the right place, they're probably going to be hooked for good. You know, people who love poetry or fall in love with poetry even later in their life, I have friends who've come to it in their 40s and 50s, and if they really latch onto it and they find a community of poets, they're going to become poets. You know, at least going to tinker with it, you know. It's an art form where there are as many practitioners as there are fans. And I think that's actually what keeps it really, really, you know, evolving and surviving.
That story's coming up in the second half of Ozarks at Large.
In the olden days, your local apothecary prepared your medication as prescribed by your physician. The pharmaceutical industry now takes care of that, mass producing everything from prescription Ambien to Xanax. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the lost art of individualized compounding is undergoing a revival.
For generations, Collier Drug has served as the corner pharmacy in Fayetteville. It's since expanded to 8 locations, including this special compounding pharmacy in Johnson, established in 2012. Pharmacy tech Carl Korbel carefully mixes a bioidentical HRT prescription under a ventilator hood inside the compounding lab.
What I'm doing here is making a compounded gel including estriol, estradiol, and progesterone.
Now, when we get sick, most of us purchase mass-produced prescription medicine prepared by multi-billion-dollar pharmaceutical drug companies. Collier compounding pharmacists provide a range of custom-prepared capsules, liquids, and topical medicines. sterile preparations such as eye drops, custom-flavored syrups, palliative or hospice products, even veterinary prescriptions. Medications are prepared without fillers, preservatives, dyes, or potential allergens. Pharmacy manager Andrew Mize takes us on a tour, starting with the sterile processing section.
The first room we enter is called our sterile prep room. What we do here is actually get the medications ready to sterilize. So this room will store our chemicals, our syringes, the different equipment that we would need. The scale that we use is called an analytical scale, meaning it goes down to a fraction of a milligram is how accurately we can measure the chemicals that we use. And every formula that we do is specific to not only the amount of ingredients and how much we weigh of each ingredient, but also step-by-step process on how to make it accurately.
The next room serves as a staging area between sterile prep and clean room.
Different injections. We can do corticosteroid injections. We can do vitamin injections. We do eye drops, nasal irrigations.
Business has doubled over the past 2 years, says Andrew Mize. The demand for compounded medicines can be traced to women starting in the late 90s seeking a healthier and less cruel alternative to manufactured hormone replacement therapy. Mass-produced HRT drugs like Premarin, conjugated equine estrogen, is derived from the urine of pregnant mares, horses that spend most of their lives confined to narrow stalls. But Andrew Mai says more women are finding relief using plant-based compounded prescription bio-HRT.
Bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, BHRT as it's commonly called, is, I would consider, our bread and butter. That's probably about 70% of what we do. We actually have taken the initial just making the creams from doctor's prescriptions. We actually now offer a consultation service that looks more in depth. We actually have a pharmacist on staff that's her primary job is to sit down with patients, to do consultations, to go through what their list of symptoms are. We actually have a test that we can do that looks at the specific hormone levels. So that way we're not just going by symptoms, but we're actually treating what that patient specifically needs.
Next, we walk into the lab where capsules, gels, and creams are prepared. Here, two part-time pharmacists as well as three technicians are working to fill more than 50 prescriptions per day.
The way that our system works, again, a focus on quality and safety for the patient. The prescription is first entered according to the prescription given by the doctor. Then that specific prescription is linked to a specific formula. Again, each of our chemicals, in order to maintain quality and safety, each chemical is individually barcoded, and each formula is specific to that using that chemical. So we can trace every lot, every chemical to exactly what it was used in.
A compounding pharmacy can also prepare topical transdermal creams for patients who can't tolerate certain manufactured oral medications.
We instead customized medications, so a patient can receive a dose that is specific for them, and so we are typically making one dose at a time, one patient at a time.
Certain unprofitable medications can be discontinued by a pharmaceutical firm, but a compounding center can formulate it and, when needed, blend several medications into a single dosage prescription. Compounders depend on U.S.-based companies like the Professional Compounding Centers of America to source top-quality chemicals. Compounded prescriptions are ordered by licensed physicians, as well as nurse practitioners and veterinarians. And the cost of compounded medications are surprisingly affordable.
The typical monthly prescription is going to range anywhere between $25 and $50, just depending on exactly what it is. So typically a little bit more than your generic copays, but oftentimes less expensive than your brand name copays.
All pharmacies do some level of in-house compounding, some much more than others, like Collier's. But in Arkansas, we also have three licensed to outsource large quantities of medication. One such firm in Massachusetts was forced to shut down in 2012. After a meningitis outbreak caused by contaminated steroid pain injections killed 64 people. and sickened more than 700 across the country. That led to passage of a new federal law, the Drug Quality and Security Act, requiring outsourcers to register with the FDA and submit to federal inspections. John Clay Kirtley is executive director of the Arkansas State Board of Pharmacies.
Although the law has been passed, the law has a lot of different technical issues that have yet to be resolved. There will be some rulemaking and regulation writing that will still have to be vetted through the process. In addition to that, there are also potentials for around the nation having new types of permits and new types of oversight. What I can speak to, though, is currently even the three pharmacies that we have that are already signing up for these outsourcing permits, you know, Arkansas is a little bit unique compared to a lot of states because we have professional pharmacists that are our inspector investigators. They've had additional training for things like sterile compounding, which is what most of this outsourcing is speaking to. And we inspect these facilities at least annually.
Andrew Mize is a graduate of UAMS College of Pharmacy, which provides state-of-the-art courses on compounding, but he also takes lots of continuing education courses.
I feel like I've only scratched the surface on what's out there. It changes every day. And the unique opportunities that you have to meet a specific need for a patient, where a patient has searched for maybe years for an answer to a certain illness or a certain treatment that they're looking for.
For example, treating joint pain with compounded prescription topical creams.
A lot of patients prefer the topical analgesics because they don't have to take it by pill. They're getting the medication they need directly where the pain is, rather than taking a pill that is more associated with more side effects.
Over-the-counter compounded pain creams are also for sale out front in the lab's store adjacent to the waiting room, along with diaper rash, migraine, and sleep aid remedies. So what's the best seller?
Probably, I would say, a toss-up between our migraine busters and our goodnight capsules. We can't seem to keep them made up enough. We sell them that quick. We actually just made a batch of our goodnight capsules yesterday and have already sold several of the bottles. So,
compounding pharmacies can be found across the state, with four in Northwest Arkansas. And the Arkansas Pharmacists Association counts nearly 100 pharmacists in its compounding academy. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
It is Wednesday, March 26th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And joining us now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor, Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And on we go with our spring break destinations.
Where are we going now?
Tulsa.
You know, Tulsa is one of those places that I'm really starting to like more and more.
There's lots to do in Tulsa.
They're kind of having this revitalization downtown, mm-hmm. sort of similar to the arts revitalization in Bentonville.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool.
Well, Allie Carter, who did this story for What's Up, found a museum in Tulsa I didn't know existed.
So it's not the Gilcrease.
No, it's called the Sherwin Miller Museum of Jewish Art.
I am not familiar with that one.
And, of course, the Holocaust is part of the topic.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this children's project called the Kinderstone Project. And young visitors get to paint a rock. And there's a number that goes with the rock. So once the stone is decorated, then the child artist finds out that that's the age of a child when he was murdered in the Holocaust.
Oh, okay.
And so the rocks are going to become part of an outdoor exhibit. So far, they've got about 3,000 of them.
Oh, wow.
So it makes a real impact on the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have an art show that is open right now that was for kids. And you can see all this at this museum or the better-known Gilcrease or Philbrook. Gilcrease, of course, Native American art, Western art. I think it's the third biggest museum of Western art in the country.
Is it?
or maybe more than that. And the Philbrook, of course, which is in a beautiful house.
That is still on my list of places to go.
Have you not been?
Every time I go there, it's for something else, and the group I'm with is like, well, we don't have time today. So
you
next
need
time.
2 days, so actually. You need a day for the galleries and a day for the gardens.
Oh, really?
It's gorgeous.
Okay, so I need to go when it gets a little warmer.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
And you can find out about all of this at NWAOnline.com/whatsup.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
So the story of David and Goliath. Improbable underdog defeats the powerful favorite, right? Maybe not.
Goliath is a sitting duck. He doesn't have a chance. So why do we keep calling David an underdog?
I'm Guy Raz. Things you thought you knew that are wrong. On the next TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Listen Sunday at noon to 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
We are right in the middle of spring break, and lots of kids are participating in camps throughout the region, and apparently it's not too early to be considering summer camps.
Whoa.
Yeah. In June, the Faye Jones School of Architecture will host its fourth summer design camp, and this year it will be offered to more ages of students and in two locations in the state. The first four-day camp is scheduled for June 16th through the 19th in Vol Walker Hall on the University of Arkansas campus here in Fayetteville. The second camp will be from June 23rd through the 26th at Garvin Woodland Gardens in Hot Springs. Concurrent camps will be held at each location for students going into ninth grade and for students going into grades 10 through 12. The camps will offer hands-on projects, tours, movies, and discussions led by architecture, landscape architecture, and interior design faculty members from the Faye Jones School. The camps are a chance for students to learn the basic elements and principles of design so that they can start thinking about the potential of a design education and profession. It's also a way for the Faye Jones School to recruit future students who show an early interest in this area. Supplies for the activities as well as lunches will be provided to the students. The cost for each camp is $250 for early registration by March 31st. The cost is $300 for registration by May 23rd. A limited number of need-based scholarships are available. To register or for more information, contact Shauna Barnes at slbarnes@uark.edu or call 575-4907.
North Arkansas Regional Medical Center, in conjunction with local businesses, is offering a 2-week summer intensive program for students entering 11th or 12th grade, those students who are interested in a wide range of healthcare careers. The Medical Application for Science and Health Program, or MASH, will be held June 16th through the 27th. MASH activities include basic life support like CPR certification, dissection, casting, and suturing activities, an overview of careers associated with medicine and health-related professionals, and team building and leadership development activities will be offered. Application requirements include recommendations from a high school health or science teacher and high school counselor, official high school transcript with at least one semester of biology and a 3.0 or greater GPA, and a face-to-face interview with the program director. Applications for the 2014 MASH program may be picked up from your high school counselor's office or from the Office of Employee Education and Training at North Arkansas Regional Medical Center, which is located at 620 North Main Street in Harrison. Applications are also available at www.narmc.com/services/education. If you have any questions, please call 870-414-4098. The deadline for the MASH program is April 1st.
Congratulations are in order for Kate Johnson, the director of the Clinton House Museum in Fayetteville. Kate was named the Arkansas Museum Association's 2014 Distinguished Museum Professional of the Year. The Distinguished Award recognizes an individual who has worked for two or more years within the museum profession and who exemplifies professionalism, teamwork, creativity, and vision. During her 5-year tenure, she's helped facilitate renovations to the museum and led an increase in attendance by 250%.
Walton Arts Center will welcome the Katherine Russell Group for two performances on Friday, April 8th. The performance is part of the Tyson Foods Starlight Jazz Club series. Single tickets for these performances will go on sale tomorrow morning at 9 and will range from $5 to $36. Tickets can be purchased by calling the Art Center at 443-5600 or visit waltonartcenter.org.
March Madness is coming to the Fayetteville Animal Shelter. This Saturday, the shelter is hosting a March Madness adoption extravaganza from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. There will be a Sweet 16 bracket made up of 8 dogs and 8 cats who will be totally free to adopt. All other pets will only be $10 to adopt all day. All pets come spayed or neutered, up to date on vaccinations and microchipped. Available animals are all sizes and ages. The shelter will also be offering free dog treats and door prizes throughout the day. All potential adopters must fill out an adoption application and be approved through the normal adoption process. You can fill out the adoption application ahead of time to be pre-approved. All pets will be available on a first-come, first-served basis. Almost all pets will be ready to go home the day of the event. For more information, contact Justine Lentz at 444-3456.
April is National Poetry Month, a designation first observed in 1996. Fayetteville is embracing the month. Maya Angelou will speak to an overflow crowd at the Fayetteville Public Library. Joyce Carol Oates, who has 10 volumes of her poetry published, will be speaking on the University of Arkansas campus. Additionally, more than 24 other events connected to the month will be staged in Fayetteville, a city with several regularly scheduled poetry readings, events, and shows every month. Since we're just days away from April, we decided to put the focus of this month's Three People segment on poetry. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums talked to Houston Hughes, a performance poet and an organizer of Fayetteville's observance next month. Jeffrey Davis, author of the forthcoming collection, Revising the Storm, and a member of the University of Arkansas faculty beginning next year. And Matthew Henriksen, a founder of the Burning Chair reading series and the author of collections of poetry. Kyle asked them about poetry's relevance in a world dominated by the 24-hour news cycle. Houston Hughes answered first.
There has to be a need for it because entertainment is everywhere now. I mean, it's, you can very easily get on the internet and there are thousands of sites dedicated to making sure you can get 15 seconds of entertainment anytime that you need and keep doing that over and over again until you're satisfied. So for poetry to take its place, it needs to have some kind of inroads that then makes it necessary for you or makes it at least enjoyable enough that you want to do it repeatedly. And I think that then comes into how poetry is presented in modern times. Because if the only exposure that people have had to poetry is studying it in school, then a lot of people are going to have a really terrible idea of what it is. If the only memory you ever have associated with something is, I was forced to learn this in school and then never used it in life, you're probably going to have a really crappy sort of association with that thing.
Jeffrey, you're nodding over there.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about this recently, having gone on various interviews, and I think it does, or I'm concerned about... Or I'm not surprised, given when I teach creative writing to college-level students, often you have to work through a similar resistance for the introductory classes. And a lot of it for me does have to go back to, or I'm always interested in trying to work against how it's presented in high school or earlier. You know, poetry is this decoding thing that will be difficult, bear through it sort of thing. And I think that starting with that sort of defeatist attitude doesn't do poetry any favors in terms of readership. And so I often start classes by presenting poetry as something that works on our existing engagement with the world, but heightens it in various ways, that we have the skill set already. It's about training those skill sets, both as readers and writers. So to try to have a more user-friendly introduction to poetry, I think at the high school level would really help with that kind of resistance, you know, walking in expecting not to get it, right? And so I try to get them to think about poetry not so much as something that means, you know, I'm using air quotes that you can't see right now, but that poetry does something to us and for us, and yeah.
Well, Matthew, you and I have talked about this before, and it's, I don't know, there are certain art forms like jazz or opera or a sport like cricket where if you're not introduced to it in a certain way, you might reject it. But once you find, I think maybe sometimes it just takes that one poem when you realize, oh, this is something that I do relate to.
Yeah, I think my attitude has changed a lot towards this, to the point where I sort of don't care what poetry does. I've seen in the last few years some articles and some publications talking about poetry's dead or it's not useful or poets are killing it. And I just sort of laugh because I've seen so many people over the years come across poetry that I find exciting and they're just like, where has this been? And the engagement's transformative, especially when I was teaching. It's the poetry that's out there that's interesting is something that people are going to find if they're looking for it. And there's poetry offers so much, and there's so many different types of poetry that are very vibrant in these sort of smaller subcultures that are totally self-sustaining. You know, when people talk about poetry being dead, it's like, no, these are the things that are thriving while our mainstream culture and our mainstream medias are just completely dying and oblivious and lacking any substance. And so I don't know. I think poets just are going to keep doing what they're doing. I mean, we all have our you know, cadres and our groups of friends, and we all just kind of thrive off of that smaller energy, and people keep coming to it. And once somebody comes in, and if somebody's looking for what poetry has to offer and they step into the right place, they're probably going to be hooked for good. You know, people who love poetry or fall in love with poetry, even later in their life, I have friends who've come to it in their 40s and 50s, and if they really latch onto it and they find a community of poets, they're going to become poets, you know, at least going to tinker with it, you know. It's an art form where there are as many practitioners as there are fans. And I think that's actually what keeps it really, really, you know, evolving and surviving outside of, you know, either outside of academia or outside of, you know, commercial sectors, or in a lot of cases outside of where the grant money is, because people just sort of grassroots sustain it.
You each have various roles of, I guess, what we would call outreach, whether you're teaching, whether you're putting together the Fayetteville celebration of National Poetry Month, whether you're putting together the Burning Chair readings or things. And you mentioned that it's out there, Matthew, if people are looking for it. But sometimes do you feel or not feel that as poets and sort of ambassadors of poetry, that you should do something else to help people find it?
Well, I mean, so one of the terms that I like using in describing myself rather than, you know, just a poet or just a teacher is to think more about my relationship to poetry as a literary citizenry. So, and I think part of helping people find it rather than find your own poetry or even poets that you love is about supporting other poetry. I mean, Matt is fabulous example of this, right? And I think that interest in reaching out and being a good reader of other people's poetry is I think one of the foundational qualities to creating a vibrant community of poetry, both writers and readers.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think another part of the overcoming problem that you talked about is people thinking of poetry as the one thing they've had an experience with. And that's like going to see one movie ever and then not liking that one movie and saying, I hate all these movie things, these motion pictures, I don't know about them. Because I imagine each of us comes not only from a different background but has a very different style. What I do is performance poetry. I'm very heavily rooted in that. And I, you know, while I'm always glad to send people the way of these other folks, like, that's not my bag. And it's, I can enjoy it now that I've gotten so far into this that I have to recognize all the roots. I have to recognize where it came from and the history and the writing necessary to do page poetry. The stage is where what I do belongs and what it's made for. And I think, again, if someone walks into
a poetry slam and says, this is too loud, this is too obnoxious, I hate poetry, that would be the most ignorant thing you could possibly do, because you've got the burning chair readings to go to, you've got literary classes, you've got all this other great stuff that you could go to. And I think it's I mean, it's human nature to want to group things like that, to be able to say, oh, I hate one thing, so I hate this whole group of poets now, these whole people. And we are as utterly different in approach as could be. I do think it's incumbent upon us to push poetry, but I think that's because poetry is a radical tool of empathy. I think that poetry, when done correctly, allows you to see things from someone else's perspective. And by the same token, to allow you to understand that someone else can see things from your perspective. That's what a good metaphor is. A good metaphor is someone who's gone inside your head and reassured you that they can see the world in a way that's similar to you. And that helps fight off depression. That helps you communicate in a better way. That can do so many amazing things for a person, regardless of what genre they decide to enter into poetry through. It's a tool, and I think that if you're not making sure everyone knows that that tool is available for their betterment as a human being, then you're failing at poetry.
Well, what does make it seem to me a bit more accessible is that person is doing that with tools I already possess. I don't have to have a guitar or a saxophone or a great arm to throw a football. It's words, and I know words. So it seems much more approachable than having to pick something up and learn how to use that.
One of the really amazing things about poetry that I think is different from almost any other art form is that our idiosyncrasies of language and of personality and of perception are what make us great poets.
Absolutely.
So you don't want to be like anyone else. And I think Houston said something earlier about getting to a certain place in his own work where he can appreciate what different types of poets are doing. And I think that's a place where I am. That's a place where a lot of my friends have gotten. But I also think it's what draws people into a slam if they're sort of uptight and they think poetry is Robert Frost, or into Burning Chair where they think poems are supposed to have a particular kind of meaning and a narrative and an order. There's this sort of equalizing thing where you just get up and it's just words. And it is really hard to get to that place you can really be confident in what you're doing. I mean, most people, you know, that I know, it takes 10, 15, 20 years before you really even get on the path. You know, once in a while it happens a little earlier. But in order to get there, you just kind of got to let everything go and just write and write and write. I wonder how many thousands of pages, air quotes, that Houston has composed, you know, and Jeffrey, I mean, between us, you know, there's probably over 100 manuscripts of work thrown out the door before we got to a place where we settled and we're like, okay, I'm writing poetry now.
Yeah. I was just talking with someone earlier about getting the question now with this book coming out, and they, for whatever reason, I always get tripped up by the question, you know, when or how long did it take you to write this book? Because it was as if it was a moment where I decided to think about the book, wrote the book, and finished the book. In large part, it just feels like, I mean, like Matt saying, this book took me all years to write it, and then someone decided that now is time to sort of put it on fancy paper in between a book cover, right? But I think part of that patience to go back to the sort of readership. I do credit a lot of, I wasn't the kind of reader that I am now until poetry, in part until probably graduate school. And I credit the patience that I developed with my own writing to the patience that I've developed working through really difficult poetry or difficult texts and spending a lot of time waiting for things to sort of become clear or waiting for what I could do with a text. And so that's another, I think, misconception is, you know, poets spend like the hour in front of the page crafting these dope poems, and then the other 223 hours being happy about their writing. And I don't think that's really, at least in my experience, it's more, if anything, not even close to the opposite, right? Where it's 23 hours of like anxiety and maybe an hour of writing a handful of words and then throwing those words away, right? Repeat. So I think the way in which reading really helps you craft a patience and a dedication that's not so demanding that results happen immediately, because that's not the way it feels, at least for this poet sitting in this chair.
Yeah, absolutely. The only thing that you need to write poetry is you need to have read at least one thing and thought that you loved it, and then read something else and thought, I can write better than that. And as long as you have those two things, then you're ready to go.
Well. Houston, April is National Poetry Month.
Yes, yes it is.
Created by an Arkansan, or at yes. least wholeheartedly endorsed yes. to its present state by then-President Bill Clinton. Fayetteville's embracing it.
Yes, absolutely. It's interesting how we got to that point, because I went to the mayor's office a couple of months ago and was like, hey, National Poetry Month's coming up. I know we've had some informal things before. I didn't know if you guys were doing anything officially. And their response was, oh, we love poetry. It'd be great if we did something. Know anyone who might be able to take that over? It's like, yeah, I guess. So, but yeah, Man, I can tell you about all the events, but I think the really important thing is the reason why you celebrate National Poetry Month, and that's because you have to let people know that I'm over here doing SLAM, and you're over there doing Burning Chair, and you're over there at the university, but it's connected. Mm-hmm. It's all so connected, and we have to be able to send people back and forth to these different things, and we have to let people know that this is not, this is not the crap that they imagined in their heads that they were forced to memorize. It's a living thing. It's alive right now. The problem isn't that people are writing eulogies for poetry. The problem is that the only poem that people have ever memorized is that eulogy. It's in their head that poetry is a dead thing, and it's our job to show them that it's alive. And that's what National Poetry Month is for. It's, you know, when people see all of the events happening in one month, and then we're like, oh, and by the way, Burning Chair and Last Saturday and Ozark Poets and Writers Collective and all these other things happen every single month. People are like, oh, I thought this was dead.
If people want to know about the readings when they happen, or websites or Facebook addresses, Burning Chair.
Oh, wow, I wonder where – I don't even know the Burning Chair website.
So that's okay.
Google Burning Chair readings. Or find the Burning Chair readings on Facebook. You can also look at Backspace on Facebook, which is a new performance space where a lot of readings are happening now.
All right. Houston?
If look up Last Saturday Fayetteville on Facebook, or National Poetry Month Fayetteville is also all over Facebook and going to be there, since we have 15 events in 30 days. Fayetteville Word Wars is our local poetry slam.
Your book's out next month.
My book is out next month. Technically, it's being released right now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so Revising the Storm by Boa Editions. I'm doing a book release that Matt's graciously putting together.
Burning Chair readings at Nightbird Books with Sarah Nicholson, another local poet who has a book coming out from Song Cave.
Very talented poet. Yeah. So April 18th, right?
April 18th.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thanks, Kyle.
Matthew Henriksen, Houston Hughes, and Jeffrey Davis talked to Ozark's at-large's Kyle Kellums inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio for our Three People series.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, caring for yourself when caring for a spouse with Alzheimer's. Is it okay to start dating again? We'll talk to people who have had firsthand experience with that. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Crosses.
And we're going to end today's show with some music by The Calamity Cubes. They're a Kansas band. They'll be at Smoke and Barrel tonight. This song is called Battle of Hair Ribbon. You can find out more about them at myspace.com/TheCalamityCubes. And just announced last night, actually, Cletus Scott Shott will be joining them. A local band will be reuniting for that show this evening tonight at Smoke and Barrel. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Have a great Wednesday.